The Conquest of Happiness by Bertrand Russell. An Adult Brain audiobook production. Read to you by Graham Dunlop. I think I could turn and live with animals. They are so placid and self-contained. I stand and look at them long and long. They do not sweat and whine about their condition. They do not lie awake in the dark and weep for their sins. They do not make me sick discussing their duty to God. Not one is dissatisfied. Not one is demented with the mania of owning things. Not one kneels to another, nor to his kind that lived thousands of years ago. Not one is respectable or unhappy over the whole earth. Walt Whitman. Preface. This book is not addressed to the learned or to those who regard a practical problem merely as something to be talked about. No profound philosophy or deep erudition will be found in the following pages. I have aimed only at putting together some remarks which are inspired by what I hope is common sense. All that I claim for the recipes offered to the reader is that they are such as are confirmed by my own experience and observation, and that they have increased my own happiness whenever I have acted in accordance with them. On this ground, I venture to hope that some among those multitudes of men and women who suffer unhappiness without enjoying it may find their situation diagnosed and a method of escape suggested. It is in the belief that many people who are unhappy could become happy by well-directed effort that I have written this book. Part 1. Causes of Unhappiness. Chapter 1. What makes people unhappy? Animals are happy so long as they have health and enough to eat. Human beings, one feels, ought to be, but in the modern world they are not, at least in a great majority of cases. If you are unhappy yourself, you will probably be prepared to admit that you are not exceptional in this. If you are happy, ask yourself how many of your friends are so. And when you have reviewed your friends, teach yourself the art of reading faces. Make yourself receptive to the moods of those whom you meet in the course of an ordinary day. A mark in every face I meet. Marks of weakness. Marks of woe. Says Blake. Though the kinds are different, you will find that unhappiness meets you everywhere. Let us suppose that you are in New York, the most typically modern of great cities. Stand in a busy street during working hours or on a main thoroughfare at a weekend or at a dance of an evening. Empty your mind of your own ego and let the personalities of the strangers about you take possession of you one after another. You will find that each of these different crowds has its own trouble. In the work hour crowd, you will see anxiety, excessive concentration, dyspepsia, lack of interest in anything but the struggle, incapacity for play, unconsciousness of their fellow creatures. On a main road at the weekend, you will see men and women all comfortably off and some very rich engaged in the pursuit of pleasure. This pursuit is conducted by all at a uniform pace, that of the slowest car in the procession. It is impossible to see the road for the cars or the scenery, since looking aside would cause an accident. All the occupants of all the cars are absorbed in the desire to pass other cars, which they cannot do on account of the crowd. If their minds wander from this preoccupation, as will happen occasionally to those who are not themselves driving, unutterable boredom seizes upon them and stamps their features with trivial discontent. Once in a way, a carload of colored people will show genuine enjoyment, but will cause indignation by erratic behavior, and ultimately get into the hands of the police owing to an accident. Enjoyment in holiday time is illegal. Or, again, watch people at a gay evening. All come determined to be happy, with the kind of grim resolve with which one determines not to make a fuss at the dentist's. It is held that drink and petting are the gateways to joy, so people get drunk quickly and try not to notice how much their partners disgust them. After a sufficient amount of drink, men begin to weep and to lament how unworthy they are, morally, of the devotion of their mothers. All that alcohol does for them is to liberate the sense of sin, which reason suppresses in saner moments. The causes of these various kinds of unhappiness lie partly in the social system, partly in individual psychology, which, of course, is itself to a considerable extent a product of the social system. I have written before about the changes in the social system required to promote happiness, concerning the abolition of war, of economic exploitation, of education and cruelty and fear. It is not my intention to speak in this volume. To discover a system for the avoidance of war is a vital need of our civilization, but no such system has a chance while men are so unhappy that mutual extermination seems to them less dreadful than continued endurance of the light of day. To prevent the perpetuation of poverty is necessary if the benefits of machine production are to accrue in any degree to those most in need of them. But what is the use of making everybody rich if the rich themselves are miserable? Education and cruelty and fear is bad, but no other kind can be given by those who are themselves the slaves of these passions. These considerations lead us to the problem of the individual. What can a man or woman, here and now in the midst of our nostalgic society, do to achieve happiness for himself or herself? In discussing this problem, I shall confine my attention to those who are not subject to any extreme cause of outward misery. I shall assume a sufficient income to secure food and shelter, sufficient health to make ordinary bodily activities possible. I shall not consider the great catastrophes, such as loss of all one's children or public disgrace. There are things to be said about such matters, and they are important things, but they belong to a different order from the things that I wish to say. My purpose is to suggest a cure for the ordinary day-to-day unhappiness from which most people in civilized countries suffer, and which is all the more unbearable because, having no obvious external cause, it appears inescapable. I believe this unhappiness to be very largely due to mistaken views of the world, mistaken ethics, mistaken habits of life, leading to destruction of that natural zest and appetite for possible things upon which all happiness, whether of men or animals, ultimately depends. These are matters which lie within the power of the individual, and I propose to suggest the changes by which his happiness, given average good fortune, may be achieved. Perhaps the best introduction to the philosophy which I wish to advocate will be a few words of autobiography. I was not born happy. As a child, my favorite hymn was, "Weary of earth and laden with my sin." At the age of 5, I reflected that if I should live to be 70, I had only endured so far a 14th part of my whole life, and I felt the long spread-out boredom ahead of me to be almost unendurable. In adolescence, I hated life and was continually on the verge of suicide, from which, however, I was restrained by the desire to know more mathematics. Now, on the contrary, I enjoy life. I might almost say that with every year that passes, I enjoy it more. This is due partly to having discovered what were the things that I most desired and having gradually acquired many of these things. Partly it is due to having successfully dismissed certain objects of desire, such as the acquisition of indubitable knowledge about something or other as essentially unattainable. But very largely it is due to a diminishing preoccupation with myself. Like others who had a Puritan education, I had the habit of meditating on my sins, follies, and shortcomings. I seemed to myself, no doubt justly, a miserable specimen. Gradually I learned to be indifferent to myself and my deficiencies. I came to center my attention increasingly upon external objects, the state of the world, various branches of knowledge, individuals for whom I felt affection. External interests, it is true, bring each its own possibility of pain. The world may be plunged in war, knowledge in some direction may be hard to achieve, friends may die. But pains of these kinds do not destroy the essential quality of life, as do those that spring from disgust with self. And every external interest inspires some activity which, so long as the interest remains alive, is a complete preventative of ennui. Interest in oneself, on the contrary, leads to no activity of a progressive kind. It may lead to the keeping of a diary, to getting psychoanalyzed, or perhaps to becoming a monk. But the monk will not be happy until the routine of the monastery has made him forget his own soul. The happiness which he attributes to religion he could have obtained from becoming a crossing sweeper, provided he were compelled to remain one. External discipline is the only road to happiness for those unfortunates whose self-absorption is too profound to be cured in any other way. Self-absorption is of various kinds. We may take the sinner, the narcissist, and the megalomaniac as three very common types. When I speak of the sinner, I do not mean the man who commits sins. Sins are committed by everyone or no one, according to our definition of the word. I mean the man who is absorbed in the consciousness of sin. This man is perpetually incurring his own disapproval, which, if he is religious, he interprets as the disapproval of God. He has an image of himself as he thinks he ought to be, which is in continual conflict with his knowledge of himself as he is. If in his conscious thought he has long since discarded the maxims that he was taught at his mother's knee, his sense of sin may be buried deep in his unconscious and only emerge when he is drunk or asleep. Nevertheless, it may suffice to take the Savior out of everything. At bottom, he still accepts all the prohibitions he was taught in infancy. Swearing is wicked, drinking is wicked, ordinary business, shrewdness is wicked. Above all, sex is wicked. He does not, of course, abstain from any of these pleasures, but they are all poisoned for him by the feeling that they degrade him. The one pleasure that he desires with his whole soul is that of being approvingly caressed by his mother, which he can remember having experienced in childhood. This pleasure being no longer open to him, he feels that nothing matters. Since he must sin, he decides to sin deeply. When he falls in love, he looks for maternal tenderness, but cannot accept it, because owing to the mother image, he feels no respect for any woman with whom he has sexual relations. Then, in his disappointment, he becomes cruel, repents of his cruelty, and starts afresh on the dreary round of imagined sin and real remorse. This is the psychology of very many apparently hard-boiled reprobates. What drives them astray is devotion to an unattainable object. Mother or mother substitute, together with the inculcation in early years of a ridiculous ethical code. Liberation from the tyranny of early beliefs and affections is the first step towards happiness for these victims of maternal virtue. Narcissism is, in a sense, the converse of a habitual sense of sin. It consists in the habit of admiring oneself and wishing to be admired. Up to a point, it is, of course, normal and not to be deplored. It is only in its excesses that it becomes a grave evil. In many women, especially rich society women, the capacity for feeling love is completely dried up and is replaced by a powerful desire that all men should love them. When a woman of this kind is sure that a man loves her, she has no further use for him. The same thing occurs, though less frequently, with men. The classic example is the hero of Liaison Dangereuse. When vanity is carried to this height, there is no genuine interest in any other person, and therefore no real satisfaction to be obtained from love. Other interests fail even more disastrously. A narcissist, for example, inspired by the homage paid to great painters, may become the art student. But as painting is for him a mere means to an end, the technique never becomes interesting and no subject can be seen except in relation to itself. The result is failure and disappointment with ridicule instead of the expected adulation. The same thing applies to those novelists whose novels always have themselves idealized as heroines. All serious success in work depends upon some genuine interest in the material with which the work is concerned. The tragedy of one successful politician after another is the gradual substitution of narcissism for an interest in the community and the measures for which he stands. The man who is only interested in himself is not admirable and is not felt to be so. Consequently, the man whose sole concern with the world is that it shall admire him is not likely to achieve his object. But even if he does, he will not be completely happy, since human instinct is never completely self-centered. and the narcissist is limiting himself artificially just as truly as is the man dominated by a sense of sin. The primitive man might be proud of being a good hunter, but he also enjoyed the activity of the chase. Vanity, when it passes beyond a point, kills pleasure in every activity for its own sake, and thus leads inevitably to listlessness and boredom. Often its source is diffidence, and its cure lies in the growth of self-respect. But this is only to be gained by successful activity inspired by objective interests. The megalomaniac differs from the narcissist by the fact that he wishes to be powerful rather than charming, and seeks to be feared rather than loved. To this type belong many lunatics and most of the great men in history. Love of power, like vanity, is a strong element in the normal human nature, and as such it is to be accepted. It becomes deplorable only when it is excessive or associated with an insufficient sense of reality. Where this occurs, it makes a man unhappy or foolish, if not both. The lunatic who thinks he is a crowned head may be, in a sense, happy, but his happiness is not of a kind that any sane person would envy. Alexander the Great was psychologically of the same type as the lunatic, though he possessed the talent to achieve the lunatic's dream. He could not, however, achieve his own dream, which enlarged its scope as his achievement grew. When it became clear that he was the greatest conqueror known to fame, he decided that he was a god. Was he a happy man? His drunkenness, his furious rages, his indifference to women, and his claim to divinity suggest that he was not. There is no ultimate satisfaction in the cultivation of one element of human nature at the expense of all the others, nor in viewing all the world as raw material for the magnificence of one's own ego. Usually, the megalomaniac, whether insane or nominally sane, is the product of some excessive humiliation. Napoleon suffered at school from inferiority to his schoolfellows, who were rich aristocrats, while he was a penurious scholarship boy. When he allowed the return of the émigrés, he had the satisfaction of seeing his former schoolfellows bowing down before him. What bliss! Yet it led to the wish to obtain a similar satisfaction at the expense of the Tsar, and this led to Saint Helena. Since no man can be omnipotent, a life dominated wholly by love of power can hardly fail, sooner or later, to meet with obstacles that cannot be overcome. The knowledge that this is so can only be prevented from obtruding on consciousness by some form of lunacy, though if a man is sufficiently great, he can imprison or execute those who point this out to him. Repressions in the political and in the psychoanalytic sense thus go hand in hand. And wherever psychoanalytic repression in any marked form takes place, there is no genuine happiness. Power kept within its proper bounds may add greatly to happiness, but as the sole end of life, it leads to disaster, inwardly if not outwardly. The psychological causes of unhappiness, it is clear, are many and various, but all have something in common. The typical unhappy man is one who, having been deprived in youth of some normal satisfaction, has come to value this one kind of satisfaction more than any other, and has therefore given to his life a one-sided direction, together with a quite undue emphasis upon the achievement as opposed to the activities connected with it. There is, however, a further development which is very common in the present day. A man may feel so completely thwarted that he seeks no form of satisfaction, but only distraction and oblivion. He then becomes a devotee of pleasure. That is to say, he seeks to make life bearable by becoming less alive. Drunkenness, for example, is temporary suicide. The happiness that it brings is merely negative, a momentary cessation of unhappiness. The narcissist and the megalomaniac believe that happiness is possible, though they may adopt mistaken means of achieving it. But the man who seeks intoxication in whatever form has given up hope except in oblivion. In his case, the first thing to be done is to persuade him that happiness is desirable. Men who are unhappy, like men who sleep badly, are always proud of the fact. Perhaps their pride is like that of the fox who has lost his tail. If so, the way to cure it is to point out to them how they can grow a new tail. Very few men, I believe, will deliberately choose unhappiness if they see a way of being happy. I do not deny that such men exist, but they are not sufficiently numerous to be important. I shall therefore assume that the reader would rather be happy than unhappy. Whether I can help him to realize this wish, I do not know. But at any rate, the attempt can do no harm. Chapter 2. Byronic Unhappiness. It is common in our day, as it has been in many other periods of the world's history, to suppose that those among us who are wise have seen through all the enthusiasms of earlier times and have become aware that there is nothing left to live for. The men who hold this view are genuinely unhappy, but they are proud of their unhappiness, which they attribute to the nature of the universe and consider to be the only rational attitude for an enlightened man. Their pride in their unhappiness makes less sophisticated people suspicious of its genuineness. They think that the man who enjoys being miserable is not miserable. This view is too simple. Undoubtedly, there is some slight compensation in the feeling of superiority and insight which these sufferers have, but it is not sufficient to make up for the loss of simpler pleasures. I do not myself think that there is any superior rationality in being unhappy. The wise man will be as happy as circumstances permit, and if he finds the contemplation of the universe painful beyond a point, he will contemplate something else instead. This is what I wish to prove in the present chapter. I wish to persuade the reader that, whatever the arguments may be, reason lays no embargo upon happiness. Nay, more, I am persuaded that those who quite sincerely attribute their sorrows to the views about the universe are putting the cart before the horse. The truth is that they are unhappy for some reason of which they are not aware, and this unhappiness leads them to dwell upon the less agreeable characteristics of the world in which they live. For modern Americans, the point of view that I wish to consider has been set forth by Mr. Joseph Wood Crutch in a book called The Modern Temper. For our grandfather's generation, it was set forth by Byron. For all time, it was set forth by the writer of Ecclesiastes. Mr. Crutch says, "Ours is a lost cause, and there is no place for us in the natural universe, but we are not, for all that, sorry to be human. We should rather die as men than live as animals." Byron says, "There's not a joy the world can give like that it takes away, when the glow of early thought declines in feeling's dull decay." The author of Ecclesiastes says, "Wherefore I praise the dead which are already dead more than the living which are yet alive. Yea, better is he than both they, which hath not yet been, who hath not yet seen the evil work that is done under the sun." All these three pessimists arrive at these gloomy conclusions after reviewing the pleasures of life. Mr. Crutch has lived in the most intellectual circles of New York. Byron swam the Hellespont and had innumerable love affairs. The author of Ecclesiastes was even more varied in his pursuit of pleasure. He tried wine, he tried music, and that of all sorts. He built pools of water, he had men servants and maid servants, and servants born in his house. Even in these circumstances, his wisdom departed not from him. Nevertheless, he saw that all is vanity, even wisdom. "And they gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is vexation of spirit, for in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow." His wisdom seems to have annoyed him. He made unsuccessful efforts to get rid of it. "I said in mine heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure, and behold, this also is vanity." But his wisdom remained with him. "Then I said in my heart, as it happeneth to the fool, so it happeneth even to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, that this also is vanity. Therefore I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous to me. For all is vanity and vexation of spirit." It is fortunate for literary men that people no longer read anything written long ago, for if they did, they would come to the conclusion that, whatever may be said about pools of water, the making of new books is certainly vanity. If we can show that the doctrine of Ecclesiastes is not the only one open to a wise man, We need not trouble ourselves much with the later expressions of the same mood. In an argument of this sort, we must distinguish between a mood and its intellectual expression. There is no arguing with a mood. It can be changed by some fortunate event or by a change in our bodily condition, but it cannot be changed by argument. I have frequently experienced myself the mood in which I felt that all is vanity. I have emerged from it not by means of any philosophy, but owing to some imperative necessity of action. If your child is ill, you may be unhappy, but you will not feel that all is vanity. You will feel that the restoring of the child to health is a matter to be attended to, regardless of the question whether there is ultimate value in human life or not. A rich man may, and often does, feel that all is vanity. But if he should happen to lose his money, he would feel that his next meal was by no means vanity. The feeling is one born of too easy satisfaction of natural needs. The human animal, like others, is adapted to a certain amount of struggle for life, and when by means of great wealth Homo sapiens can gratify all his whims without effort, the mere absence of effort from his life removes an essential ingredient of happiness. The man who acquires easily things for which he feels only a very moderate desire concludes that the attainment of desire does not bring happiness. If he is of a philosophic disposition, he concludes that human life is essentially wretched, since the man who has all that he wants is still unhappy. He forgets that to be without some of the things you want is an indispensable part of happiness. So much for the mood. There are, however, also intellectual arguments in Ecclesiastes. The river runs into the sea, yet the sea is not full. There is no new thing under the sun. There is no remembrance of former things. I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. If one were to attempt to set up these arguments in the style of a modern philosopher, they would come to something like this. Man is perpetually toiling, and matter is perpetually in motion, yet nothing abides, although the new thing that comes after it is in no way different from what has gone before. A man dies, and his heir reaps the benefits of his labors. The rivers run into the sea, but the waters are not permitted to stay there. Over and over, again in an endless, purposeless cycle, men and things are born and die without improvement, without permanent achievement, day after day, year after year. The rivers, if they were wise, would stay where they are. Solomon, if he were wise, would not plant fruit trees on which his son is to enjoy the fruit. But in another mood, how different all this looks. No new thing under the sun. What about skyscrapers, aeroplanes, and the broadcast speeches of politicians? What did Solomon know about such things? Note, Ecclesiastes was not, of course, really written by Solomon, but it is convenient to allude to the author by this name. If he could have heard on the wireless the speech of the Queen of Sheba to her subjects on her return from his dominions, would it not have consoled him among his futile trees and pools? If he could have had a press-cutting agency to let him know what the newspaper said about the beauty of his architecture, the comforts of his harem, and the discomfitures of rival sages in argument with him, could he have gone on saying that there is no new thing under the sun? It may be that these things would not have wholly cured his pessimism, but he would have had to give it a new expression. Indeed, one of Mr. Crutch's complaints of our time is that there are so many new things under the sun. If either the absence or the presence of novelty is equally annoying, it would hardly seem that either could be the true cause of despair. Again, take the fact that all the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. Regarded as a ground for pessimism, this assumes that travel is unpleasant. People go to health resorts in the summer, yet return again unto the place whence they came. This does not prove that it is futile to go to health resorts in the summer. If the waters were endowed with feeling, they would probably enjoy the adventurous cycle after the manner of Shelley's Cloud. As for the painfulness of leaving things to one's heir, that is a matter that may be looked on from two different points of view. From the point of view of the heir, it is distinctly less disastrous. Nor is the fact that all things pass in itself any ground for pessimism. If they were succeeded by worse things, that would be a ground, but if they are succeeded by better things, that is a reason for optimism. What are we to think if, as Solomon maintains, they are succeeded by things exactly like themselves? Does not this make the whole process futile? Emphatically not, unless the various stages of the cycle are themselves painful. The habit of looking to the future and thinking that the whole meaning of the present lies in what it will bring forth is a pernicious one. There can be no value in the whole unless there is value in the parts. Life is not to be conceived on the analogy of a melodrama in which the hero and heroine go through incredible misfortunes for which they are compensated by a happy ending. I live and have my day, my son succeeds me and has his day, his son in turn succeeds him. What is there in all this to make a tragedy about? On the contrary, if I lived forever, the joys of life would inevitably in the end lose their savor. As it is, they remain perennially fresh. I warmed both hands before the fire of life. It sinks, and I am ready to depart. This attitude is quite as rational as that of indignation with death. If, therefore, moods were to be decided by reason, there would be quite as much reason for cheerfulness as for despair. Ecclesiastes is tragic. Mr. Crutch's modern temper is pathetic. Mr. Crutch, at bottom, is sad because the old medieval certainties have crumbled, and also some that are more recent origin. As for this present unhappy time, he says, haunted by ghosts from a dead world and not yet at home in its own, its predicament is not unlike the predicament of the adolescent who has not yet learned to orient himself without reference to the mythology amid which his childhood was passed. This statement is entirely correct as applied to a certain section of intellectuals, those, namely, who, having had a literary education, can know nothing of the modern world, and having throughout their youth been taught to base belief upon emotion, cannot divest themselves of that infantile desire for safety and protection which the world of science cannot gratify. Mr. Crutch, like most other literary men, is obsessed with the idea that science has not fulfilled its promises. He does not, of course, tell us what these promises were, but he seems to think that 60 years ago men like Darwin and Huxley expected something of science which it has not given. I think this is an entire delusion fostered by those writers and clergymen who do not wish their specialties to be thought of little value. That the world contains many pessimists at the present moment is true. There have always been many pessimists whenever there has been many people whose income has diminished. Mr. Crutch, it is true, is an American, and American incomes, on the whole, have been increased by the war. But throughout the continent of Europe, the intellectual classes have suffered terribly, while the war itself gave everyone a sense of instability. Such social causes have a great deal more to do with the mood of an epoch than has its theory as to the nature of the world. Few ages have been more despairing than the 13th century, although that faith, which Mr. Crutch so regrets, was then firmly entertained by everyone except the emperor and a few great Italian nobles. Thus, Roger Bacon says, "For more sins reign in these days of ours than in any past age, and sin is incompatible with wisdom. Let us see all conditions in the world and consider them diligently everywhere. We shall find boundless corruption and, first of all, in the head. Lechery dishonors the whole court, and gluttony is lord of all. If then this is done in the head, how is it in the members? See the prelates, how they hunt after money and neglect the cure of souls. Let us consider the religious orders. I exclude none from what I say. See how far they are fallen. One and all from their right state, and the new orders of friars are already horribly decayed from their first dignity. The whole clergy is intent upon pride, lechery, and avarice, and wheresoever clerks are gathered together, as at Paris and Oxford, they scandalize the whole laity with their wars and quarrels and other vices. None care what is done or how, by hook or by crook, provided only that each can fulfill his lust." Concerning the pagan sages of antiquity, he says, "Their lives were beyond all comparison better than ours, both in all decency and in contempt of the world, with all its delights and riches and honors, as all men may read in the works of Aristotle, Seneca, Tully, Avicenna, Alpharabius, Plato, Socrates, and others. And so it was that they attained to the secrets of wisdom and found out all knowledge. Roger Bacon's opinion was that of all his literary contemporaries, not one of whom liked the age in which he found himself. I do not for a moment believe that this pessimism had any metaphysical cause. Its causes were war, poverty, and violence. One of Mr. Crutch's most pathetic chapters deals with the subject of love. It appears that the Victorians thought very highly of it, but that we, with our modern sophistication, have come to see through it. For the more skeptical of the Victorians, love performed some of the functions of the god whom they had lost. Faced with it, many of even the most hard-headed turned for the moment mystical. They found themselves in the presence of something which awoke in them that sense of reverence which nothing else claimed, and something to which they felt, even in the very depth of their being, that an unquestioning loyalty was due. For them, love, like God, demanded all sacrifices, but like him also it rewarded the believer by investing all the phenomena of life with a meaning not yet analyzed away. We have grown used, more than they, to a godless universe, but we are not yet accustomed to one which is loveless as well, and only when we have so become shall we realize what atheism really means. It is curious how different the Victorian age looks to the young of our time from what it seemed when one was living in it. I remember two old ladies, both typical of certain aspects of the period, whom I knew well in my youth. One was a Puritan, the other a Voltairean. The former regretted that so much poetry deals with love, which she maintained is an uninteresting subject. The latter remarked, "Nobody can say anything against me, but I always say that it is not so bad to break the seventh commandment as the sixth, because at any rate it requires the consent of the other party." Neither of these views was quite like what Mr. Crutch presents as typically Victorian. His ideas are derived evidently from certain writers who were by no means in harmony with their environment. The best example, I suppose, is Robert Browning. I cannot, however, resist the conviction that there is something stuffy about love as he conceived it. "God be thanked, the meanest of his creatures boasts two soul sides, one to face the world with, one to show a woman when he loves her." This assumes that combativeness is the only possible attitude towards the world at large. Why? "Because the world is cruel," Browning would say. "Because it will not accept you at your own valuation," we should say. A couple may form, as the Brownings did, a mutual admiration society. It is very pleasant to have someone at hand who is sure to praise your work, whether it deserves it or not. And Browning undoubtedly felt that he was a fine, manly fellow when he denounced Fitzgerald in no measured terms for having dared not to admire Aurora Leigh. I cannot feel that this complete suspension of the critical faculty on both sides is really admirable. It is bound up with fear and with the desire to find a refuge from the cold blasts of impartial criticism. Many old bachelors learn to derive the same satisfaction from their own fireside. I lived too long myself in the Victorian age to be a modern according to Mr. Crutch's standards. I have by no means lost my belief in love, but the kind of love that I can believe in is not the kind that the Victorians admired. It is adventurous and open-eyed, and, while it gives knowledge of good, it does not involve forgetfulness of evil, nor does it pretend to be sanctified or holy. The attribution of these qualities to the kind of love that was admired was an outcome of the sex taboo. The Victorian was profoundly convinced that most sex is evil, and had to attach exaggerated adjectives to the kind of which he could approve. There was more sex hunger than there is now, and this is no doubt caused by people to exaggerate the importance of sex, just as the ascetics have always done. We are at the present day passing through a somewhat confused period, when many people have thrown over the old standards without acquiring the new ones. This leads them into various troubles, and as their unconscious usually still believes in the old standards, the troubles, when they come, produce despair, remorse, and cynicism. I do not think the number of people to whom this happens is very large, but they are among the most vocal people of our time. I believe that if one took the average of well-to-do young people in our day and in the Victorian epoch, one would find that there is now a great deal more happiness in connection with love and a great deal more genuine belief in the value of love than there was 60 years ago. The reasons which led certain persons to cynicism are connected with the tyranny of the old ideals over the unconscious, and with the absence of a rational ethic by which present-day people can regulate their conduct. The cure lies not in lamentation and nostalgia for the past, but in a more courageous acceptance of the modern outlook and a determination to root out nominally discarded superstitions from all their obscure hiding places. To say shortly why one values love is not easy. Nevertheless, I will make the attempt. Love is to be valued in the first instance, and this, though not its greatest value, is essential to all the rest, as in itself a source of delight. O love, they wrong thee much, that say thy sweet is bitter, when thy rich fruit is such as nothing can be sweeter. The anonymous author of these lines was not seeking a solution for atheism or a key to the universe. He was merely enjoying himself. And not only is love a source of delight, but its absence is a source of pain. In the second place, love is to be valued because it enhances all the best pleasures, such as music and sunrise in mountains and the sea under the full moon. A man who has never enjoyed beautiful things in the company of a woman whom he loved has not experienced to the full the magic power of which such things are capable. Again, love is able to break down the hard shell of the ego, since it is a form of biological cooperation in which the emotions of each are necessary to the fulfillment of the other's instinctive purposes. There have been in the world at various times various solitary philosophies, some very noble, some less so. The Stoics and the early Christians believed that a man could realize the highest good of which human life is capable by means of his own will alone, or at any rate without human aid. Others again have regarded power as the end of life, and yet others mere personal pleasure. All these are solitary philosophies in the sense that the good is supposed to be something realizable in each separate person, not only in a larger or smaller society of persons. All such views, to my mind, are false, and not only in ethical theory, but as expressions of the better part of our instincts. Man depends upon cooperation, and has been provided by nature, somewhat inadequately, it is true, with the instinctive apparatus out of which the friendliness required for cooperation can spring. Love is the first and commonest form of emotion leading to cooperation, and those who have experienced love with any intensity will not be content with a philosophy that supposes their highest good to be independent of that of the person loved. In this respect, parental feeling is even more powerful, but parental feeling at its best is the result of love between the parents. I do not pretend that love in its highest form is common, but I do maintain that in its highest form it reveals values which must otherwise remain unknown, and has itself a value which is untouched by skepticism. Although skeptics who are incapable of it may falsely attribute their incapacity to their skepticism, true love is a durable fire, in the mind ever burning, never sick, never dead, never cold, from itself never turning. I come next to what Mr. Crutch has to say about tragedy. He contends, and in this I cannot but agree with him, that Ibsen's Ghosts is inferior to King Lear. No increased powers of expression, no greater gift for words could have transformed Ibsen into Shakespeare, the materials out of which the latter created his works, his conception of human dignity, his sense of the importance of human passions, his vision of the amplitude of human life, simply did not and could not exist for Ibsen, as they did not and could not exist for his contemporaries. God and man and nature had all somehow dwindled in the course of the intervening centuries, not because the realistic creed of modern art led us to seek out mean people, but because this meanness of human life was somehow thrust upon us by the operation of that same process which led to the development of realistic theories of art, by which our vision could be justified. It is undoubtedly the case that the old-fashioned kind of tragedy which dealt with princes and their sorrows is not suitable to our age, And when we try to treat in the same manner the sorrows of an obscure individual, the effect is not the same. The reason of this is not, however, any deterioration in our outlook on life, but quite the reverse. It is due to the fact that we can no longer regard certain individuals as the great ones of the earth who have a right to tragic passions, while all the rest must merely drudge and toil to produce the magnificence of those few. Shakespeare says, "When beggars die, there are no comets seen. The heavens themselves blaze forth the death of princes." In Shakespeare's day, this sentiment, if not literally believed, at least expressed an outlook which was practically universal and most profoundly accepted by Shakespeare himself. Consequently, the death of Cinna the poet is comic, whereas the deaths of Caesar, Brutus, and Cassius are tragic. The cosmic significance of an individual death is lost to us because we have become democratic, not only in outward forms, but in our inmost convictions. High tragedy in the present day, therefore, has to concern itself rather with the community than with the individual. I would give as an example of what I mean Ernst Toller's Mazenmensch. I do not maintain that this work is as good as the best that has been done in the best ages in the past, but I do maintain that it is justly comparable. It is noble, profound, and actual, concerned with heroic action and purging the reader through pity and terror, as Aristotle said it should. There are as yet few examples of this modern kind of tragedy, since the old technique and the old traditions have to be abandoned without being replaced by mere educated commonplace. To write tragedy, a man must feel tragedy. To feel tragedy, a man must be aware of the world in which he lives, not only with his mind, but with his blood and sinews. Mr. Crutch talks throughout his book at intervals about despair, and one is touched by his heroic acceptance of a bleak world. But the bleakness is due to the fact that he and most literary men have not yet learnt to feel the old emotions in response to the new stimuli. The stimuli exist, but not in literary coteries. Literary coteries have no vital contact with the life of the community, and such contact is necessary if men's feelings are to have the seriousness and depth within which both tragedy and true happiness proceed. To all the talented young men who wander about feeling that there is nothing in the world for them to do, I should say, give up trying to write and instead try not to write. Go out into the world. Become a pirate, a king in Borneo, a laborer in Soviet Russia. Give yourself an existence in which the satisfaction of elementary physical needs will occupy almost all your energies. I do not recommend this course of action to everyone, but only to those who suffer from the disease which Mr. Crutch diagnoses. I believe that after some years of such an existence, the ex-intellectual will find that in spite of his efforts, he can no longer refrain from writing, and when this time comes, his writing will not seem to him futile. Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.